going to talk about Islam and Jews and in the Islamic world, which is a very significant piece of Jewish history. First of all, because Islam, being one of the three great monotheistic faiths, plays a major role in modern history. Certainly modern, I mean the last 1,300 years or so. Definitely in terms of study of Israel in the Middle East, the vast majority of time in the last 1,300 years, Israel has been ruled by Islamic, not Arabs. You have to always distinguish between the two, Islamic regimes. Okay, because there are some Islamic regimes that are Arabs and some Islamic regimes that are not, like Turkey. They're Islamic, but they're not Arab. Don't call Turk an Arab. Thank you very much. Or Indonesia, which is the largest Islamic country in the world, but is definitely not Arab. So, anyway, before we look at the relationship between Jews and the Islamic world, we need to, of course, step out, as I say, macrocosmically and spend a little time looking at what's going on in the ancient Near East and, of course, the origins of Islam. Just as we looked at Christianity, there's definitely a lot of Jewish connections. First of all, when Islam appears as a major world religion, we're talking about the 7th century of the Common Era. Okay, what's going on? Remember, Western Roman Empire has already been gone for several hundred years. Israel is, except for about a dozen years prior to it being conquered by the Muslims in 638, is under the control of the Eastern Christian, Byzantine Empire. Remember those guys? Byzantium. And those guys are going to be around until 1453, actually. They're going to last literally 1,000 years longer than the Western Empire. So that's what's controlling Israel. Now, most of the Jewish population of the world at this time is where? It's not in Byzantine control. Remember, we're talking about, if you remember, what's going on, 7th century, there's no Sanhedrin anymore, no Nasi. Jewish population of Israel is quite diminished. The majority of the Jews are living in the Arabian Peninsula, and they really haven't spread out too much. Most of the Jews are living in the area of Iraq, Iran, even some in Saudi Arabia, where Jewish tribes running around. So this is where the majority of the Jews are, living amongst Arab pagans. Okay? Now, Arab pagans, I mean, in the Persian world, there's the Sassanian Empire, who are the new Persians. We mentioned those guys. They are Zoroastrians, right? These dualist guys we mentioned. We talked about exotic religions of the Eastern world. So you have the majority of the Jews, the vast majority, 90% of the Jewish population of the world is living under control of various pagan Arab or Persian. We got the Arab Persians, not the same people, or Persians. Okay, this is where Islam is going to appear. And by the way, if the Islamic view of the pre-Islamic Arabian Peninsula is called the Jahiliya, which is the period of time when paganism was the dominant religion. The Arabs obviously consider Zoroastrianism, I think on the border, early Islam considered it. Not really quite so pagan, but not monotheistic. Okay, so that's what's going on in the world at large. The most important character, obviously, in Islam is a man by the name of Muhammad ibn Abdullah. Okay? Muhammad, the son of Abdullah. Abdullah, interesting, the word Allah. Abdullah is Evid Allah. You know, in Hebrew you have the word El, which is also a Jewish god, but it's like a certain Canaanite god called the name El. So the pagan Arab god also had the name of Allah too, which later will be transformed into the one God. So his father's name is Abdullah, servant of the God Allah. This is obviously before the monotheistic idea of Allah comes in the world. But anyway, Muhammad is born in 570. Now, unlike, we talked about Christian history, unlike the historical Jesus, so to speak, which exists in a vacuum. There's no evidence, there's no biography from the time. He didn't, whether the person, I already gave you my opinion on this, that he's a composite character, probably living way before the events the New Testament describes. We don't have such a problem with Muhammad. No one argues that Muhammad is a real historical figure. Okay? And also, there's also a significantly easier thing with Muhammad. No one's claiming Muhammad's God. Okay, he is Rasul Allah, which is the prophet of Allah, but he's not God. Okay, so we're doing a different kind of character in history. Muhammad is, again, at a very young age, he's orphaned. Okay, his actual years, if you want, is 570 to 632, he dies. He is orphaned, and he's raised by his uncle. He's from the tribe of Quraysh, and is very big in the Arabian Peninsula. And this is still very much, if you study this the anthropology and the sociology of the Arab Islamic world, and you realize that the basic traits that characterize the Arab mentality have nothing to do with Islam. Okay, meaning if you read a guy like Raphael Patai, who wrote a great book called The Arab Mind, he explains it very nicely. Like, one of the basic things that the Arab world is obsessed with is this concept of honor. Okay, jazid, I think it's called, I believe is the right word. Manliness and honor. Okay, sexual fidelity of women is a big obsessive thing in the Islamic world. And hospitality. These are all pre-Islamic, I say. These are all very much part of Arab culture that predates the Islamic world. And one could trace some of it back, certainly. Remember we said, going all the way back many, many classes, we said just as, we went back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their offshoots, right? We have a direct line of descendants who create the Jewish people, and we have offshoots in each generation who go off the track and don't create Judaism, but indirectly or directly are going to be responsible for the other great monotheistic faiths. We already mentioned, right, we talked about Christianity coming from Rome, Edom, coming from Esav, coming from Jacob's twin. And, of course, we have even a more obvious and direct connection is the Islamic connection, meaning Abraham's second wife, Hagar, Ishmael. Okay, and the Bible refers to all the nomadic guys wandering around as Ishmaelites. And as soon as Islam appears on the scene, they are going to immediately connect themselves up to being the descendants of Abraham through Ishmael. Okay, and Abraham has a specific, there's a lot of reverence for Abraham in the Islamic world. He's called the Khalil, the friend. Okay, and as I mentioned before, that Jaffa gate is called Bab el Khalil, which is because that's the gate you went out of to go to Hebron, where Abraham is buried. But they're going to definitely make that connection. So we see just the two great monotheistic faiths claim to be in some way descended from Judaism. It's interesting, offshoots, not Judaism, but from our progenitors also. Okay, so the Islamic world, the pre-Islamic Arab world is broken up into tribes. Muhammad is from the tribe of Quraysh. In the year 610, we know not too much about his life. He was a merchant. The nomadic Arabs living in that part of the world, in the Arabian Peninsula, most of them were involved in trade. They had huge caravans. He married a wealthy widow considerably older than he. I think she was about 40. He was 25. Interesting, parents are very nice shidduch, because during her lifetime, he never took another wife. Later, he will marry several wives. Most famous is this woman, Aisha. A lot of Arab women are named Aisha. That's his later second favorite wife. But I guess having lots of money and making money in business, he had leisure time to meditate. I'm giving you the Islamic view in a nutshell. He apparently would go meditate in a cave, and about 610, the prophet Jibril is Gabriel, all the Arabs take. David is Daoud, right? They have him. Spoke to Muhammad in a cave and told him to read, which is a problem because he was illiterate. And that's according to Islamic tradition, the wonder of the Quran, which is the Islamic holy book. It was actually put together later, but according to Islamic tradition, it is actually the words that come through Muhammad, and even though he was illiterate, he was able to be literate when it came to putting the Quran together. It's one of the miracles that the Islamic world talks about. This is where Muhammad recognizes himself as a prophet, and he gets into a lot of trouble immediately after. Living in Mecca, which was the center of pre-Islamic Arab paganism, if anyone knows anything, you ever seen National Geographic has a great photo spread on Mecca, which is the holiest city in the Islamic world. They have the great mosque of Mecca. In the middle is this black stone. In the corner is this meteorite called the Kaaba. This is the holiest spot in the Islamic world. That, going back before Muhammad and before Islam, it was a pagan shrine. Okay, Muhammad starts preaching his own version of monotheism and gets into a lot of trouble with the local pagans. Now, where does Muhammad get his ideas from? This is very important. We're talking about Christianity, that how Christianity is clearly based on a lot of Jewish ideas, the attractiveness of Judaism versus the difficulty when Paul comes along, right, and makes a modified version of Judaism without mitzvot that finds very fertile ground in the pagan world of the Roman Empire. So, too, Muhammad definitely is very, of his own admission, very much influenced by the monotheists he comes in contact with, because there are a large number of monotheistic people. In Islam, the word Hanif is for monotheist, who's a non. In this part of the world, there were lots of Jews, as we know already, I mentioned. 90% of the Jewish world is living amongst the Arabs, or the Persians, and there are also lots of Christians. Okay? And it's clear that Muhammad gets his ideas of monotheism from those people. And it's also clear he didn't get it too clearly, because you read in the Quran, there's a lot of, in the different surah, the chapter of the Quran, there's a lot of confusion in chronology, you know, and Joseph goes down to Egypt, and then he marries Mary, and Jesus is born, that kind of stuff, you know. So they weren't so interested in the accuracy of the transmission, per se, but suffice it to say, he very clearly models his new faith on Jewish and Christian ideas. And again, Islam will take the same sort of attitude that Christianity will take towards Judaism. Islam will take towards Christianity and Judaism, which is a sort of replacement theology. Meaning, just as the Christians recognize Jewish prophets to be prophets, but now we have the New Testament and God has chosen us, so too Islam will say Moses is a prophet, you know, Jesus is a prophet. Everything's cool, but Muhammad is the final prophet. Okay? Now, there's a lot of differences between, this is not a class on what Islam's all about, but just in a nutshell, there's no question that Islam is much closer to Judaism. And there's no question that it's an inception, it was much, much closer. Muhammad clearly tried to fashion his religion to be very similar to Judaism, realizing that Jews, who stood to be significant allies because they were very significant percentage of the population, would not follow a religion that was radically different from Judaism. So initially we know that that Muslims, early Muslims, would pray towards Jerusalem, that the Sabbath was their holy day, Yom Kippur was the holiest day of the year, they had kosher laws and circumcision laws, and you name it. Lots of similarities. Much of that is going to change when the Jews will reject Muhammad, Muhammad will reject the Jews. Okay, but initially we know there's a lot of, so it's important to realize not just an idea of Ishmael and the Arabs, but a more modern, contemporary history, only 1,300 years ago, there's a definite, very strong Jewish influence on early Islam. Absolutely. Now he saw the Jews did not go for Christianity because Paul had gutted. They never went for Christianity anyway. But there was no chance that Jews would go for something so radically different. Forgetting the whole notion of Trinity, which, by the way, the Islamic world finds really hates. Matter of fact, one of the psukim, one of the sentences on the inside of the Dome of the Rock. Not that I've been up there. But actually says, you know, don't tell me that God has a son. You know, it's basically nonsense. They find that Muslim is very strictly monotheistic religion, unlike Christianity, which has its sort of like pagan variation, you know, virgin births and stuff like that, which is not at all acceptable to Islam. Which is one of the reasons why a Jew can pray in a mosque but not in a church. You can go in a mosque, no problem. You might not want to go in a mosque because you might get killed for being a Jew, but not necessarily. But you can pray in one. There's definitely a lot of differences. And just to go through a little bit of the history of the spread of Islam, and I want to talk a little bit about the religion and then talk about the Jews in the Islamic world. So first of all, Muhammad, once he starts preaching in the name of Allah, okay, he runs into trouble. Originally he has the backing of his tribe. Again, we're talking about a lot of the way the political system of the Arab world runs is tribal and clan loyalties. Okay, an idea of Pan-Arab nationalism is a very new idea. It's a tribe. It's a very, very big thing. It's a very feudal kind of macho system based on raiding and honor and blood feuds. And I don't have time to go into it. Again, read some books on Arab culture. It's very, very different. Yeah?
The Christians, their God, from what I understand, same God, I think they even call it the same name. Their God, the same name. But the Muslims call it their God Allah. Do they say the same God?
It's the same. No, the Muslim idea of God is much closer to the Jewish idea. Names are not relevant. That is the conception. The nature of God in Christianity is the most hotly contested issue in the theological history of a Christian church. But certainly the notion of that he's one, but he has parts, and the Father, that's...
So if they're referring to Hashem as Allah, that's what they say Allah?
You could say Allah. It's not saying Allah is not like saying Jesus, but it isn't the same thing. I would say it's closer, but not identical. Okay, but their conception of God is certainly closer. The name, even the word God, where even the word God comes from. God is not a Jewish word. You know, we say Hashem. You know, God. We talk about infinity. So the name is really. I think the name is really sort of irrelevant. It's the conception. The Christian conception of God, regardless of what sect of Christianity, is far more problematic for Jews and is totally unacceptable versus the Islamic conception, which is not a problem of what their idea of God is, but rather what God does in history, meaning he chose someone else. That's more of a problem. So it's not the word Allah. You don't have to say we Jews don't usually say Jesus. We say JC, Yeshu, Yoshki, Yoshkala, whatever you want to call them. that man, you know, the acrobat, whatever you want to say he is, but whatever you want to call him, but we don't generally say it, okay? Whereas Allah, okay, different thing. We're dealing with it's obviously the problems with Christian conception of Jesus is much more problematic. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about Islam's greatest hits now being broadcast over the loudspeaker in just a couple of minutes. Okay, Muhammad 6:10, right, starts to preach. Okay, he has to flee. He loses the support of his local clan because of what's going on. I don't want to go into the history of what's going on in his family. He flees to a place called Yathrib. Yathrib is a place that's occupied by five major Arab clans, three of which are Jewish clans. When I say Arab, meaning Arabic, this part of the world, but like American Jews, they're Jews. Jews had clans, just like everyone else, okay? They probably had, you know, different tastes in food, they had cholent, who knows, but they had clans. The city of Yathrib was almost certainly founded by Jews, who, by the way, called it Medina. You know, like, what's the word for Medina? Who knows modern Hebrew? Medina means country, okay? Muhammad is brought in, invited into Medina to, by the way, arbitrate a dispute, and when he does that successfully, he's nominally put in charge of running Medina. He then starts, so I'm running through this very quickly, he has all kinds of back and forth disputes with the pagan Arabs of Mecca and several battles they try and invade Medina. He's more or less victorious. During this period of time, he basically gains allies in Medina and gets several of the clans to actually convert to Islam. So he's building a following. Now the Jews don't go along with this, and what's eventually going to happen is the Jewish tribes are going to be either killed or expelled. Okay, there's several major battles where the Muslim armies beat not just the pagan Arabs of Mecca, but also of the Jews of Medina. The starting of, by the way, of the Islamic calendar it's a word called Hijra, H-I-J-R-A. Okay, or H-I-J-I-R-A, I don't know how you spell it in English exactly. Hijra is the year 622. That's the year one of the Islamic calendar, which is the year that Muhammad has to flee from Mecca to Medina. Now, by 10 years later, he's back in Mecca victorious. He's invited into the city. The governor of Mecca basically converts to Islam, and the rest is history. Now, Muhammad dies in 632. Not too long after this, he's gone. Okay, and there's a series of the followers of Muhammad who lead Islam are called the Caliphs. Okay, the first guy is Abu Bakr, who I believe is Muhammad's uncle. Okay? There's a whole bunch of caliphs who follow one in succession of another. Okay? And then some of them, to be the caliph, you have to be either one chosen by popular demand, meaning a qualified guy, and or a descendant of Muhammad. The problem with Muhammad is he had no sons. He has this daughter, Fatima, who later marries his first cousin, Ali. Okay? Ali has two sons, Hassan and Hussein, who are eventually, we're talking about, not you don't have to keep track of all this, but what we're going to have is after the first four caliphs, there's going to be a huge power struggle in the Islamic world, in which there's a big battle called the Battle of Karbala, in which Hussein's two sons are killed, and that, by the way, is a split in the Islamic world where Sunni and Shiaism is formed. We're talking about in the 8th century now. So Shiites, who make up like 10% of the Islamic world, almost all Muslims are Sunnis. There's a few Alawites in Syria, but most of them are Sunnis. Shiites believe that the caliph has to be a direct descendant of Muhammad from the family of Ali and Hussein. Okay? So we have a big split in the Islamic world, and they've been fighting ever since. Okay? Shiites, by the way, follow a much more messianic, sort of extreme version of Islam. All you have to do is look at what the Iranians do to realize they have some interesting holidays. By the way, their third holiest site for Sunni Muslims, we'll talk about in a minute, Sunni Muslims is Jerusalem. For Shiites, it's Karbala, which is the site of the battle where Hussein's two sons are killed. Okay, and they have a holiday at the end of their big month, which we're in right now, Ramadan, which is called Ashura, which is great. I have pictures of it where they sit there and they flagellate themselves and they cut their heads with knives. I have a great picture of a woman holding her like 1-year-old son, and she just cut his head with a razor blade and he's dripping with blood, and this is like a big thing. It's the whole martyrdom shtick again. So you have to watch. I've seen movies of this holiday with all these Shiites in the streets whipping themselves and bleeding and cutting themselves in the heads with knives, and you know, I think I prefer Purim. Anyway, but we have a, not just a split between Shiites and Sunni, who, by the way, hate each other's guts. Later we're going to have Druzim coming. I don't even get into them. But even we're going to have a series of dynasties in the Islamic world that are going to appear one after the other and dominate the Middle East. The first major dynasty is called the Umayyads, followers of the Caliph of Omar, who was one of the early caliphs after Muhammad. And the Caliph of Omar, who actually comes to Jerusalem in 638. Once Muhammad consolidates power by 632, he's more or less the most powerful man in the Arabian Peninsula. And his followers who come along, starting with Abu Bakr, spread Islam through the ancient Near East. And not just through the ancient Near East, but through the entire, from North Africa. The Islamic world is going to spread remarkably rapidly. The question is, why does Islam spread so effectively? And it's very different from the spread of Christianity. Islam's, you know, the notion, by the way, that of like the Islamic idea of jihad, or convert or die, was the reason why Islam spread so effectively. It sounds nice, but it's really not so true historically. Okay, there were definitely instances early on in Islam where people were forced to convert or be killed. When Muhammad was not in a great position, it was definitely done, there's no question. There are instances later in Islamic history of forced conversions, even of Jews, definitely. But in theory, Islamic law forbids forced conversion. One of the main reasons why Islam spread so rapidly is A, because it was very attractive at the time to many people, and B, because the average person in the ancient Near East preferred Muslims to anyone else. Who was in charge before Muhammad comes along and the Islamic world spreads? You had the Sassanids, the Sassanid, the Persian dynasty, who were kind of corrupt and not such nice people. And even worse, you had the Byzantines, who everyone seems to have hated. Even all the non-Eastern Orthodox Christians in the ancient Near East, the Copts and the Monophysites and the Jacobites, everyone hates the Byzantines. The Jews hated the Byzantines. So even Christians, when Islam comes along, which is initially fairly tolerant. When it comes along, people would much prefer to be under the rule of these new guys with this new religion who seem to be pretty open compared to people like the Byzantines. And there's definitely a huge force. Islam had the whole idea of an ummah, of a pan-Islamic, you know, view of the world, caught on tremendously and turns what is a bunch of disparate nomadic peoples into a giant, very excellent fighting force. One of the great things that the early Islamic armies had was they're very mobile, right? They had camels. They could disappear into the desert. They were great fighters. So they were able to beat both the Byzantines and the Persians, who, by the way, had done the Arabs the favor of exhausting themselves by killing each other off for a couple of decades prior to the Islamic conquest of the whole ancient Near East. So a little bit of history. The Byzantine Emperor Heraclius, in 612, the Persians conquered Jerusalem from the Byzantines and sacked the city. They destroyed the Church of Holy Sepulchre. 624, Heraclius reconquers Jerusalem, but they've been fighting constantly. So by the time the Arab Islamic armies appear on the scene, there's really nothing there to stop them. So we're going to see they're going to spread very, very rapidly. The Caliph of Omar is going to come to Jerusalem in 638. Okay? And Islam, I want to talk about the Islamic connection to Jerusalem in a minute, but Islam is going to continue to spread. It's going to constantly be banging on the gates of the Byzantine Empire until they finally fall down all the way in the 15th century. It's going to get all the way out to China. It's going to go all through North Africa. In 711, we're going to talk about that tomorrow. The Arabs, not the convenience store, the date, 711. The Islamic world is going to cross the Straits of Gibraltar and take over Spain from the Visigoths. And as a matter of fact, if not for Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours in the middle of the 8th century, right outside Paris, probably the Islamic world would have taken over the Christian world and all of human history would have been different. So talking about an unstoppable, almost an unstoppable force in the first 100 years of Islam, incredibly remarkable spread of a religion. And today, by the way, Islam is the fastest spreading religion in the world, primarily because it's located in countries that have incredibly high birth rates. But it is also a religion that views itself as a universal religion for humankind. Just want to mention a little teeny bit about the Islamic worldview more. Yeah. Byzantine Empire is very weak. First of all, they didn't control the entire Arabian Peninsula. Parts of the Middle East were controlled by Byzantine, like Jerusalem and Lebanon. parts were, but they ruled over people. They were Eastern Orthodox Christians. They ruled over primarily Maronites, Jacobites, Monophysites, Copts, all kinds of other Christian sects. There's a lot of them who the Byzantines hated. The Byzantines hated everyone. They hated the Latin Church, and we talk about the Crusades. They thought everyone was a crude, primitive person compared to them, they being the people who survived from the Roman Empire and spoke Greek. And it's like the Romans didn't conquer everyone. There's just whole parts of the Middle East that were not under their control. Okay. Just talk a little bit more about the Islamic worldview. First of all, Islam has five pillars. You know, Quran we already talked about, their holy book. 114 surah of the Quran, the chapters in it, okay? There is all Islamic law, Sharira, there's the Hadith, the stories of Muhammad's life, I'm not going to get into any of that. But the five pillars of Islam are, and it's important to know, because you see there's a lot of similarities between Islam and Judaism. First one is Shahada. Shahada is the Islamic Shema, okay, which is La ilaha illa Allah wa Muhammad Rasul Allah, which you'll always hear when these guys start shrieking out. That's the basic, you say that twice in front of kosher witnesses, you're a Muslim, right? So be careful you say it in front of. It's La ilaha illa Allah, La ilaha illa Allah, there is no God but Allah, wa Muhammad Rasul Allah. And Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. Okay, that's their number one idea. That's like their, no, there is a God. The second thing is Salat, which is prayer, which Muslims pray five times a day. Okay, they took it from, by the way, the five times a day Jews pray on Yom Kippur. Okay, the third thing is Zakat, which really means charity. Islamic world is supposed to give, you see they're cheaper than Jews, 2.5%, not 10%, 2.5%, okay? The fourth is Hajj. Hajj is the pilgrimage that you make to Mecca. A Muslim is supposed to go once in his life to Mecca to make this pilgrimage. There's a whole month that the Hajj takes place in. There's a whole ritual you go through. Only Muslims are allowed to go to Mecca. Okay, you cannot go unless you do that. It's amazing. And during the Hajj season, you have 7 million Muslims circling, not at one time, but in Mecca, and hundreds of thousands going around the Kaaba. It's a really cool thing. You can't go there and watch it, but you can to see it happening. And last but not least, there's a Tzom, which is Tzom in Hebrew. Tzom is what?
Fast.
Tzom of Ramadan, which is the Muslim holy month, which we're in now, which is 30 days of fasting from dawn till dusk, and you can eat at night. You think Yom Kippur is rough. Try doing it for 30 days. And this is the Muslim holy month. At the end of the holy month, there's a holiday called Eid al-Fitr. This is the big Muslim holiday. The other big Muslim holiday besides the month of the Hajj is Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice, which is commemorating when, which takes place at the end of the Hajj, which commemorates the time when Abraham bought Ishmael up to the Akedah. Okay, they changed the story and no one sued them for plagiarizing it. But so we have, and the last, those are the five pillars, okay? The sixth addition is jihad, okay, which we all know so well. Now, it's not really, jihad does not mean holy war, by the way. Jihad means struggle. Real jihad, if you ask someone who really knows Islam, an Islamic cleric, it's the internal struggle. You know, it's like their Muslim movement, kind of like, you know, the struggle between good and evil. But jihad also has a wider connotation, which is very important to the whole Islamic view of the world and how they view the Jews and the Christians and everywhere else in the world. The basic Islamic view of the world is there's Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harab. Harab, Kherev. In Hebrew, semi-Islamic. But Kherev, lo yisagoyal go Kherev, sword. There's the world of Islam and the world of the sword. There's that part of the world that's accepted Islam and that part of the world that is yet to be conquered and is outside the world of Islam. Islam views itself, its destiny is a universal faith destined to conquer all of humanity. This explains the very aggressive nature of the spread of Islam in history, and this explains a lot of the Islamic attitude towards the rest of the world, and it says oceans about the Islamic attitude towards a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. Because this is a part of the world that has been under control of Islam, and that's a fundamental part of Islam, is that any part of the world that has been under Islamic control has to be returned to that control, number one. Okay? And now, what's the Islamic attitude towards non-Muslims? So the basic attitude is that non-Muslim pagans have to convert. Sometimes they were killed if they didn't convert. Okay, people who are hanifim, who are monotheists but not Muslims, are tolerated and have a status called dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I. Very important word to know if you study Islam. Dhimmi means protected people, meaning you are a monotheist and not a pagan, therefore we tolerate your existence. But it's not like you're protected, it sounds nice, I protect you as a Muslim. Dhimmi means second-class citizen, in practical, all practical application of the word. Now, Christians and Jews are called Ahal al-Katib in Islam, in Arabic. Katib is Ktiv. What's Ktav in Hebrew? See that false? Writing. The people of the book. What book? The Bible. And the Christian, okay, they have the New Testament also. But the Islamic world views Jews and Christians having a certain status. You know, they had prophets that were cool, right? Jesus, Moses, they're all cool, but we're now we're the guys who are chosen now. But they are Dhimmi. Okay, they are these second-class citizens, which means, now, how Jews are treated, in theory, Dhimmi laws are very specific in terms of restricting the rights of these peoples, what they can and cannot do. Like, you can't be on an animal riding high like a horse rather than, you have to step into the gutter when a Muslim walks by. You can't testify in court against a Muslim. There's all kinds, you can't have Muslim slaves or servants. You can't have a house of worship that is higher than a mosque, which is why the four Sephardic synagogues in the Old City are subterranean, and why the Ramban synagogue is built underground. Because to show the inferiority of these other Dhimmi religions to Islam. Even the Horva, the synagogue with the arch, the Beit Yaakov, which was one of the first of two synagogues, the Tiferet Yisrael and the Horva, one of two synagogues allowed by the Turks in the 19th century to be built above ground. So the Arabs immediately built a mosque next to the Horba, higher than the synagogue, to show that even though the Jews have a synagogue above ground, the mosque is still there. You see it in the Jewish quarter, right next to the arch. Islam is still superior. By the way, of course, one of the major ways that Islam was able to spread effectively was through a tax called the jizya. Jizya was a punitive tax placed on people who didn't convert to Islam. So it was in your best interest financially. You see, poor Jews, we get it in the Christian world, we get it in the Roman world, we get it in the Muslim world. I mean, you know why Jews, when they hear the word tax, they just like start like... That's why so many Jews are accountants today. So one of the reasons, and of course all that money was divided up between the loyal followers of Muhammad, and there's a whole hierarchy of who splits up the spoils in the early Islamic world. Okay, so in terms in general... general rule about how the Islamic world has treated the Jews. Now, obviously, as Islam expands, it is going to end up absorbing the vast majority of Jews of the world are going to end up in the Islamic world. Remember we talked about the Shivas in Babylon. This is all taking place at this time. I mentioned, by the way, they all move eventually to Baghdad. Baghdad, which is established during the Abbasid dynasty around 750, is going to become like the center of the Arab world. Okay, and really the 8th century is the golden age with the Abbasid dynasty. It's really, most people consider the golden age of Islam. That's like the high point of Islamic culture. And obviously, in my personal opinion, it's not just mine, one of the main reasons why Islam does so well is because it has a huge number of Jews, which it is more or less tolerant of. And the Jews are allowed to operate very freely in the Islamic world. Okay, and what Jews are doing in the Middle East is very similar economically and intellectually to what Jews are doing in Europe. We have Jews involved in all kinds of trades and craftsmen, okay, and translators and businessmen and you name it, okay, Jews doing everything in sciences and arts, and we have Jews doing a tremendous amount, and there's no question that the Islamic world benefits tremendously from that, and unlike the Christian world, which by, as we mentioned yesterday, we're talking about medieval anti-Semitism, is going to eventually clamp down on all Jewish creativity and economic expression, the Islamic world more or less doesn't do that, and Jews will generally do better economically and not economically, but even religiously. That's on one hand. On the other hand, it's not true to say, this is like modern Arab propaganda, especially the PLO loves to say this, until Zionism came along and polluted the wonderful atmosphere of friendship, Jews and Arabs lived as brothers in the Middle East. Now, I know plenty of people I've met plenty of people in my life who've lived in Arab countries and have lived even in Israel, and had Arabs as neighbors pre-Palestine, pre-State of Israel. So it's true that Jews and Arabs definitely lived amongst each other, and generally not so ghettoized as we find in Europe. But again, we have to keep in mind that we do have this idea of Dhimmi, and the official Muslim policy towards Jews is negative and discriminatory. Now, how well that policy was observed or practiced varies tremendously. We have plenty of places where it was barely kept at all, and Jews did very, very well. The best example is where? Where is the place that Jews did better in the Islamic world at any period of time in Islamic history? In Spain, starting in the early 8th century for the next 300 years. Okay, especially during the Almoravids, who are these nomadic sort of Berber-type Arab converts to Islam who were going to march into Spain at that time. Okay, there you have Jews rising to incredible positions of power, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, some of the personalities. Although at no time were Jews ever equal to Muslims in the entire history of Islam. There were periods of time of remarkable tolerance, but never real equality. Never happened. Okay, and then you have places under the Almohades, who also Berbers from North Africa, who were viciously oppressive, who forcibly converted Jews and had pogroms and you name it, who were terrible to the Jews. Same Islamic code and theory, but how it was practiced very different. Today we see the same thing. The more like King Hassan of Morocco, who has just died recently, who was remarkably tolerant. I was a little kid. I lived in Morocco. I was a little kid. My father was in the Air Force. And Hassan I told Hassan II, which is when I was living there a long time ago, when on his deathbed, he said, "You better be nice to these Jews, because if they leave, the country falls apart." Which is not the first time or the last time that people have said that in history, Gentiles, about having Jews in their country. Whereas you get people like in Iran, like the Ayatollah Khomeini, not a very nice guy, and his followers, who were incredibly oppressive of everyone else, and of course the Shiites are even more fanatical, Jews don't do well there. So you have tremendous variation. So there's no hard and fast rule about how well Jews do or don't do. Okay, so you have to keep that in mind. So we have a religion, comes out of Judaism, takes over much of the world, okay, absorbs most of the Jewish population into that population, and Jews will do, depending upon it. We don't have time to go into all the dynasties and who treated Jews how, but it varies tremendously. And pretty much from 638, from the Caliph of Omar coming here and conquering Jerusalem, with the one exception being the Crusades, as I mentioned before, from 1099 until 1187, that's the only break when you're not going to have Islamic rulers ruling over the land of Israel. And you have different dynasties coming in here. You're going to have the Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Fatimids, the Seljuks, the Mamelukes, the Ottomans. By the way, none of whom make this place their capital. Jerusalem's more or less a run-down, dumpy place. Now, the last few minutes of the class, I do want to talk about the Islamic connection to Jerusalem. The Jewish Bible, Jerusalem is mentioned 750 times. Okay, the Quran does not mention Jerusalem once. In the 17th surah, the 17th chapter, the first verse, it mentions that Muhammad has a dream of a midnight ride. He gets on his flying horse, El Barak, and he flies from Mecca. El Barak was a huge horse with the body of a woman, the tail of a peacock, had all these legs. It flies to El Aqsa, the farthest place. Okay, and there he meets the prophet Jibril again, okay, Gabriel, and he goes up to heaven. He spends 40 days touring around that 40-day motif again. The seventh heavens, meeting all the prophets and talking to Moses and Jesus and hanging out and whatever he does. Okay? When the Caliph of Omar comes to Jerusalem in 638, he doesn't find much of anything going on here, by the way. He also lost control of Mecca. Now, there's the problem that Muslims have to make a pilgrimage, a Hajj, to Mecca, which he doesn't control. So he says, well, you know what? That midnight ride, which is only a dream, really, El Aqsa is the southwest corner of the Temple Mount. That's where Muhammad comes. That's where he lands. And you know where he ascends to heaven? On the stone where the Solomon's Temple stood. Okay, and you can still see the footprint there today, so to speak. Okay, and he is, according to legend, the person who discovers the site. There's very interesting stories about the Caliph of Omar and his sanctification of Jerusalem. But since that time, for Sunni Muslims, Jerusalem is the third holiest site. Again, I mentioned that for Shiites, it's Karbala. The site of the battle is, I believe, the third holiest site. He doesn't build the Gold Dome, by the way. The Gold Dome is built later by later Umayyad rulers in Jerusalem. The man who builds the Gold Dome is a man by the name of Abdul al-Malik in 691. He builds that dome. That dome, by the way, the dimensions of that dome match exactly the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Because when the Muslims came here, they liked the size and the form so nice, so they copied it exactly and made their own version there. Although most of history was nowhere near as nice. Like 10, 12 years ago, King Hussein of Jordan, who recently died, sold one of his houses in London and gold-plated it with 80 kilos of gold. But for most of history, it's more or less a rundown site. But that That very pretty building is the oldest Muslim holy site in the world. It predates the Great Mosque in Mecca, built in 691. That is not a mosque. That is a shrine over the place where, A, the Jewish temple stood, and, B, where Muhammad ascended to heaven from the rock, according to Islamic tradition. The actual mosque is the Black Dome. They're redoing the roof. You can look right out the window here and see it. That's Al-Aqsa. It was built by Abdul Malik's son, Al-Walid, in 701. Okay? So those are, this is their, and they call this place today Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary. The correct name for Jerusalem, they call it El-Quds, from Kudash, from Kodesh, holy. So that's the Islamic connection to Jerusalem. But it's important to take note. If you look on the top of the Gold Dome, on the top of the mosque, you'll see this moon, the sign of Islam. That moon always faces towards the direction of Saudi Arabia, towards the Kaaba. Okay, in every mosque, there's a niche in the wall, which is called the Mukhrab. The Mukhrab is, from our case, points south to Mecca, and the direction is called the Qibla, which is the direction that Muslims pray. It's very important to remember that today, although technically the Jews control the Temple Mount, it is in fact controlled by the Muslim religious authority, the Waqf, which does all kinds of illegal excavations up there, as you see going on right now. And when Arabs pray up there now, Muslims on Ramadan, their holiest month, they stick their tushies in the direction of the Gold Dome, where the Kodesh HaKadoshim, where all Jews in the world for all of human history point to when we pray. Our holiest spot is here. This is their third holiest site. They stick their tushies in that direction. They pray south to Mecca. So for us, it's the holiest site. It's very important. It's this very big distinction. I hate when tour guides say the Western Wall is the holiest site for the Jews. It's not. It's where the temple stood itself. Okay, it's very, very important. And obviously, there's a big, in terms of the politics of what's going on in this part of the world, the fight, and it bears the fight over who controls the Temple Mount is the fundamental issue here. And you can be sure that for the entire period of time when the Islamic world is here, it's very interesting to note that there are no Arabs, no Islamic Arab regimes or any other Arab, or Turks, whatever, who make their capital city here. It remains pretty much a backwater, run-down place. The only time a lot of building is done here during the Islamic period is during the Mamluks in the 13th century. After the Crusades, the Mamluks felt that because we Muslims were not venerating Jerusalem enough, that's why the Crusaders, Allah gave it to the Crusaders. So let's put a lot of money into building projects. So they built a lot of beautiful buildings here. But more or less, even the Temple Mount area, it was more or less run down and dumpy. Once the Jews get interested in the site, a lot more money is going to be put into it. And it's very interesting that even the Western Wall, which is where we go to pray now, the Muslims claim, you Jews prayed there? Muhammad tethered his horse El Burak to that wall. And until today, that wall is called El Burak. Okay, so the Jews are never, the Islamic world is always more or less denied. I had a pamphlet from the PLO, from the PLA, about the Temple Mount. It's fascinating. It says, the Temple Mount is the site of the third holiest site in Islam, you know, El Quds, Haram al-Sharif, the place where Muhammad took. Some people say it was also the site of Solomon's Temple and of Herod's Temple, but there's no archaeological evidence to support this whatsoever. Of course, they destroyed it all, but it's just a great piece of modern revisionism to say that there's no archaeological evidence. It obviously is. Anyway, that is, in a nutshell, Islam and the Islamic connection to Jerusalem. To